controlling Iraq's oil. I mean the people who turned faith-based initiatives into Karl Rove's slush fund, who encouraged the pious to look heavenward and pray so as not to see the long arm of privilege and power picking their pockets. I mean the people who squelch free speech in an effort to obliterate dissent and consolidate their orthodoxy into the official view of reality from which any deviation becomes unpatriotic heresy. That's who I mean. And if that's editorializing, so be it. A free press is one where it's okay to state the conclusion you're led to by the evidence. One reason I'm in hot water is because my colleagues and I at Now didn't play by the conventional rules of Beltway journalism. Those rules divide the world into Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, and allow journalists to pretend they have done their job if instead of reporting the truth behind the news, they merely give each side an opportunity to spin the news. Jonathan Merman writes about this in a recent essay in World Policy Journal. Merman quotes David Ignatius of the Washington Post on why the deep interests of the American public are so poorly served by Beltway journalism. The rules of the game, says Ignatius, make it hard for us to tee up on an issue without a news peg. He offers a case in point. The debacle of America's occupation of Iraq. If Senator so-and-so hasn't criticized post-war planning for Iraq, says Ignatius, it's hard for a reporter to write a story about that. Merman also quotes public television's Jim Lehrer, whom I greatly respect, acknowledging that unless an official says something is so, it isn't news. Why were journalists not discussing the occupation of Iraq? Because, says Jim Lehrer, the word occupation was never mentioned in the run-up to the war. Washington talked about the war as a war of liberation, not a war of occupation. So as a consequence, those of us in journalism, says Lehrer, never even looked at the issue of occupation. In other words, says Jonathan Merman, if the government isn't talking about it, we don't report it. He concludes Lehrer's somewhat jarring declaration, one of many recent admissions by journalists that their reporting failed to prepare the public for the calamitous occupation that has followed the liberation of Iraq, reveals just how far the actual practice of American journalism has deviated from the First Amendment idea of a press that is independent of government. Take the example, also cited by Merman, of Charles Hadley. Hadley is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Associated Press, whose 2003 story of the torture of Iraqis in American prisons, before a U.S. Army report and photographs documenting the abuse surfaced, was ignored by major American newspapers. Hadley attributes this lack of interest to the fact, quote, it was not an officially sanctioned story that begins with a handout from an official source. Furthermore, Iraqis recounting their own personal experience of Abu Ghraib simply did not have the credibility with Beltway journalists of American officials denying that such things happened. Judith Miller of the New York Times, among others, relied on that credibility of official but unnamed sources when she served essentially as the government's stenographer for claims that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. So the rules of the game permit Washington officials to set the agenda for journalism, leaving the press all too simply to recount what the officials say instead of subjecting their words and deeds to critical scrutiny. Instead of acting as filters for readers and viewers, sifting the truth from the propaganda, reporters and anchors attentively transcribe both sides of the spin, invariably failing to provide context, background, or any sense of which claims hold up and which are misleading. I decided long ago that this wasn't healthy for democracy. I came to see that news is what people want to keep hidden, and everything else is publicity. In my documentaries, whether on the Watergate scandal 30 years ago, or the Iran-Contra conspiracy 20 years ago, or Bill Clinton's fundraising scandals 10 years ago, or 5 years ago, the chemical industry's long and despicable cover-up of its cynical and unspeakable withholding of critical data about its toxic products, I realized that investigative journalism could not be a collaboration between the journalist and the subject. Objectivity was not satisfied by two opposing people offering competing opinions, leaving the viewer to split the difference. I came to believe that objective journalism means describing the object being reported on, including the little fibs and fantasies as well as the big lie of people in power. In no way does this permit journalists to make accusations and allegations. It means instead making sure that your reporting and your conclusions can be nailed to the post with confirming evidence. This is always hard to do, but it's never been harder. Without a trace of irony, the powers that be have appropriated the newspeak vernacular of George Orwell's 1984. They give us a program vowing no child will be left behind while cutting funds for educating disadvantaged children. They give us legislation cheerily calling for clear skies and healthy forests that give us neither while turning over our public lands to the energy industry. In Orwell's 1984, the character Syme, one of the writers of that totalitarian society's dictionary, explains to the protagonist Winston, "Don't you see that the whole aim of newspeak is to narrow the range of thought? Has it ever occurred to you, Winston, that by the year 2050, at the very latest, not a single human being will be alive who could understand such a conversation as we are having right now? The whole climate of thought," he said, "will be different. In fact, there will be no thought as we understand it now. Orthodoxy means not thinking, not needing to think. Orthodoxy is unconsciousness. An unconscious people, an indoctrinated people, a people fed only partisan information and opinion that confirm their own bias, a people made morbidly obese in mind and spirit by the junk food of propaganda, is less inclined to put up a fight, ask questions, and be skeptical. And just as a democracy can die of too many lies, that kind of orthodoxy can kill us too." I learned about this the hard way. I grew up in the South, where the truth about slavery, race, and segregation had been driven from the pulpits, driven from the classrooms, and driven from the newsrooms. It took a bloody civil war to bring the truth home, and then it took another 100 years for the truth to make us free. Then I served in the Johnson administration, imbued with Cold War orthodoxy, and confident that might makes right, we circled the wagons, listened only to each other, and pursued policies the evidence couldn't carry. The results were devastating for Vietnamese and Americans. I brought all of this to the task when PBS asked me after 9/11 to start a new weekly broadcast. They wanted us to make it different from anything else on the air, commercial or public broadcasting. They asked us to tell stories no one else was reporting and to offer a venue to people who might not otherwise be heard. That wasn't a hard sell. I had been deeply impressed by studies published in two leading peer-reviewed scholarly journals. Their extensive research on the content of public television over a decade found that political discussions on our public affairs programs generally included a limited set of voices that offer a narrow range of perspectives on current issues and events. Instead of far-ranging discussions and debates, the kind that might engage viewers as citizens and not simply as audiences, this research found that public affairs programs on PBS stations were populated by the standard set of elite news sources, whether government officials and Washington journalists talking about political strategy, or corporate sources talking about stock prices or the economy from the investor's viewpoint. Public television, unfortunately, all too often was offering the same kind of discussions and a similar brand of insider discourse that is featured regularly on commercial television. Who didn't appear was also revealing. In contrast to the conservative mantra that public television routinely featured the voices of anti-establishment critics, the studies found that alternative perspectives were rare on public television and were effectively drowned out by the stream of government and corporate views that represented the vast majority of sources on our broadcasts. The so-called experts who got most of the FaceTime came primarily from mainstream news organizations and Washington think tanks rather than diverse interests. Economic news, for example, was almost entirely refracted through the views of business people, investors, and business journalists, voices outside the corporate Wall Street universe, non-professional workers, labor representatives, consumer advocates, and the general public were rarely heard. In sum, these two studies concluded, the economic coverage was so narrow that the views and the activities of most citizens became irrelevant. All of this went against the Broadcasting Act of 1967 that created the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I know, I was there. As a young policy assistant to President Johnson, I attended in 1964 my first meeting to discuss the future of public broadcasting. I know firsthand that the Public Broadcasting Act was meant to provide an alternative to commercial television and to reflect the diversity of the American people. So this, too, was on my mind when we assembled the team for now. We agreed on two priorities. First, we wanted to do our part to keep the conversation of democracy going. That meant talking to a wide range of people across the spectrum, left, right, and center. It meant poets, philosophers, politicians, scientists, sages, and scribblers. It meant Isabel Allende, the novelist, and Amity Schleier, the columnist for the Financial Times. It meant the questing former nun and best-selling author Karen Armstrong, and it meant the right-wing evangelical columnist Cal Thomas. It meant Arundhati Roy from India, Doris Lessing from London, David Suzuki from Canada, and Bernard-Henri Levy from Paris. It also meant two successive editors of the Wall Street Journal, Robert Bartley and Paul Gigot, the editor of The Economist, Bill Emmett, the Nation's Katrina Vandenhoevel, and the Los Angeles Weekly's John Powers. It meant liberals like Frank Wu, Ossie Davis, and Gregory Nava, and conservatives like Grover Norquist, Frank Gaffney, and Richard Vigory. It meant Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and Bishop Gregory, the chairman of the Catholic Bishops' Conference in this country. It meant the conservative Christian activist and lobbyist, Ralph Reed, and the dissident Catholic sister, Joan Chittister. We threw the conversation of democracy open to all comers, and most of those who came responded the same way that Republican and Libertarian Congressman from Texas, Ron Paul, did, who wrote me after his appearance to say, "I've received hundreds of positive emails from your viewers. I appreciate the format of your program, which allows time for a full discussion of ideas. I'm tired of political shows featuring two guests shouting over each other and offering the same arguments. Now was truly refreshing." Hold your applause, because that's not the point of the story. We had a second priority. We intended to do strong, honest, accurate, and impartial reporting, telling stories we knew people in high places wouldn't like. I told our producers and correspondents that in our field reporting, our job was to get as close as possible to the verifiable truth. This was all the more imperative after 9/11. America could be entering a long war against elusive and stateless enemies with no definable measure of victory and no limit to its duration, cost, or foreboding fear. The rise of a homeland security state, meant government could justify extraordinary measures in exchange for protecting citizens against unnamed, even unproven threats. Furthermore, increased spending during an emergency can produce a spectacle of corruption behind a smokescreen of secrecy. I reminded our team of the words of the news photographer in Tom Stoppard's play, who said people do terrible things to each other, but it's worse when everyone is kept in the dark. I reminded them of how my colleague, the correspondent and historian Richard Reeves, answered a student who asked him to define real news. Real news, Reeves answered, is the news we need to keep our freedoms. For these reasons, and in that spirit, we went about reporting on Washington as no one else in broadcasting, except occasionally 60 Minutes, was doing. We reported on the expansion of the Justice Department's power of surveillance. We reported on the escalating Pentagon budget and expensive weapons that didn't work. We reported on how campaign contributions influenced legislation and policy to skew resources to the comfortable and well-connected while our troops were fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq with inadequate training and armor. We reported on how the Bush administration was shredding the Freedom of Information Act. We went around the country to report on how closed-door, backroom deals in Washington were costing ordinary workers and taxpayers their livelihood and security. And we reported on offshore tax havens that enable wealthy and powerful Americans to avoid their fair share of national security and the social contract. And always, always, because what people know depends on who owns the press, we kept coming back to the media business itself, to how mega media corporations were pushing journalism further and further down the hierarchy of values, how giant radio cartels were silencing critics while shutting communities off from essential information, and how the mega media companies were lobbying the FCC for the right to grow ever more big, ever more powerful. The broadcast caught on. Our ratings grew every year. There was even a spell when we were the only public affairs broadcast on PBS whose audience was going up instead of down. Our journalistic peers took notice. The Los Angeles Times said Now's team of reporters has put the rest of the media to shame, pursuing stories few others bother to touch. The Philadelphia Inquirer said our segments on the sciences, the arts, politics, and the economy were provocative public television at its best. The Austin American-Statesman called Now the perfect antidote to today's high-pitched decibel level, a smart, calm, timely news program. Fraser Moore of the Associated Press said we were hard-edged when appropriate, but never hardball. Don't expect combat, he told his readers. Civility reigns on Now. And the Baton, listen to this. And the Baton Rouge Advocate said Now invites viewers to consider the deeper implication of the daily headlines, drawing on a wide range of viewpoints which transcend the typical labels of the political left or right. The Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 had been prophetic. Open public television to the American people. Offer diverse interests, ideas, and voices. Be fearless, fearless in your belief in democracy, and they will come. Hold your applause. That's not the point of the story. The point of the story is something only a couple of my closest associates, including my wife and partner, Judith, and I knew at the time. We didn't share this with the rest of our staff. We knew that the success of Now's journalism was creating a backlash in Washington. The more compelling our journalism, the angrier became the radical right of the Republican Party. That's because the one thing they loathe more than liberals is the truth. The quickest way to be damned by them as liberal is to tell the truth. This is the point of my story. Ideologues don't want you to go beyond the typical labels of left and right. They embrace a worldview that cannot be proven wrong because they will admit no evidence to the contrary. They want your reporting to validate their belief system. And when it doesn't, God forbid. Never mind that their own stars were getting a fair shake on now. Jugo, Vigory, David Keene of the American Conservative Union, Stephen Moore of the Club for Growth. Our reporting was giving the radical right fits because it wasn't the party line. It wasn't that we were getting it wrong either. Only 3 times in 3 years did we err factually, and in each case we corrected those errors as soon as we confirmed their inaccuracy. I believe our broadcast was the best researched on public broadcasting. And the problem was that we were telling stories the partisans in power didn't want told, and we were getting it right, not right wing. Let me tell you something. I've always thought the American eagle needed a left wing and a right wing. The right wing would see to it that economic interests had their legitimate concerns addressed. The left wing would see to it that ordinary people were included in the bargain. And both would keep the great bird on course. But with two right wings, or two left wings, it's no longer an eagle, and it's going to crash. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I have to tell you that my occasional, and I didn't do them that often, my occasional commentaries got to them as well. Although apparently he never watched the broadcast, I guess he couldn't take the diversity, Senator Trent Lott came out squealing like a stuck pig when, after the midterm elections in 2002, I described what was likely to happen now that all three branches of government were about to be controlled by one party dominated by the religious, corporate, and political right. Instead of congratulating the winners for their election victory, as some network broadcasters did, or celebrating their victory, as Fox, The Washington Times, The Weekly Standard, Talk Radio, and other partisan Republican journalists did, I provided a little independent analysis of what the victory meant. And I did it the old-fashioned way. I looked at the record, took the winners at their word, and drew the logical conclusions that they would use power as they had said for 25 years they would. And then, of course, I set it forth in my usual modest Texas way. Events since then have confirmed the accuracy of what I said. I had our research team, and I worked very much with them, put together the mainstream news clippings to support every sentence in that particular post-election analysis. But then, strange things begin to happen. Friends in Washington called to say that they had heard of muttered threats that the PBS reauthorization would be held up unless Moyers is dealt with. The chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Kenneth Tomlinson, was said to be quite agitated. I didn't know it at the time, but within 3 months after taking over, he wrote a letter to PBS complaining about the unbalanced now.
You're listening to Bill Moyers in defense of public broadcasting. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Apparently there was apoplexy in the right-wing area, particularly when I closed the broadcast one Friday night by putting a flag in my lapel. Here's a copy of what I said. I wore my flag tonight, first time. Until now, I haven't thought it necessary to display a little metallic icon of patriotism for everyone to see. It was enough to vote, pay my taxes, perform my civic duties, speak my mind, and do my best to raise our kids to be good Americans. Sometimes I would offer a small prayer of gratitude that I'd been born in a country whose institutions sustained me, whose armed forces protected me, and whose ideals inspired me. I offered my heart's affection in return. It no more occurred to me to flaunt the flag on my chest than it did to pin my mother's picture on my lapel to prove her son's love. Mother knew where I stood. So does my country. I even tuck a Valentine in my tax returns on April 15th. So what's this doing here? I put it on to take it back. The flag's been hijacked and turned into a logo. The trademark of a monopoly on patriotism. On those Sunday morning talk shows, official chests appear adorned with the flag as if it's the good housekeeping seal of approval. No administration's patriotism is ever in doubt, only its policies. And the flag bestows no immunity from error. When I see flags sprouting on official labels, I think of the time in China when I saw Mao's little red book of orthodoxy on every official's desk. Omnipresent and unread. But more galling than anything are all those moralistic ideologues in Washington sporting the flag in their lapels while writing books and running websites and publishing magazines attacking dissenters as un-American. They are people whose ardor for war grows disproportionately to their distance from the fighting. They're in the same league as those swarms of corporate lobbyists wearing flags and prowling Capitol Hill for tax breaks, even as they call for spending more on war. So I put this on as a modest riposte to men with flags in their lapels who shoot missiles from the safety of Washington think tanks, or argue that sacrifice is good as long as they don't have to make it, or approve of bribing governments to join the coalition of the willing. I put it on to remind myself that not every patriot thinks we should do to the people of Baghdad what bin Laden did to us. The flag belongs to the country, not to the government. And it reminds me that it's not un-American to think that war, except in self-defense, is a failure of moral imagination, political nerve, and diplomacy. Come to think of it, standing up to your government can mean standing up for your country. That did it. And our continuing reporting on overpricing at Halliburton, chicanery on K Street, and the heavy, if divinely guided, hand of Tom DeLay. When Senator Lott protested that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has not seemed willing to deal with Bill Moyers, a new member of the board, a Republican fundraiser named Cheryl Halperin, who had been appointed by President Bush, agreed that CPB needed more power to do just that sort of thing. She left no doubt about the kind of penalties she would like to see imposed on the malefactors. Now, hear me again. As rumors circulated about all this, I asked to meet with the entire CPB board. I wanted to hear for myself what they were saying. I thought it would be helpful for someone like me who'd been present at the creation and part of the system for almost 40 years to talk about how CPB had been intended to be a heat shield to protect public broadcasters from exactly this kind of intimidation. After all, I'd been there at the time of Richard Nixon's attempted coup. In those days, public television had been really feisty and independent, and often targeted for attacks. A Woody Allen special that poked fun at Henry Kissinger and the Nixon administration had actually been canceled. John Stewart wouldn't have stood a chance if he'd started his career on PBS. The White House had been so outraged over a documentary called The Banks and the Poor about discrimination by rich financial institutions against the poor that PBS was driven to adopt new guidelines. That didn't satisfy Nixon, and when public television hired two NBC reporters, the radicals Robert McNeil and Sander Van Oker, to co-anchor some new broadcast, it was for Nixon the last straw. According to White House memos of the time, He was determined, quote, to get the left-wing commentators who are cutting us up off public television at once. Indeed, yesterday, if possible. Sound familiar? Nixon vetoed the authorization for CPB with a message written in part by his sidekick and soulmate, Pat Buchanan, who castigated Van Oker, McNeil, Washington Week in Review, Black Journal, and Bill Moyers as, quote, unbalanced against the administration. It is familiar. Buchanan and Nixon succeeded in cutting CPB funding for all public affairs programming except for Black Journal. They knocked out multi-year funding for the National Public Affairs Center for Television, otherwise known as IMPACT, and they voted to take away from the PBS staff the ultimate responsibility for the production of programming. But in those days, and this is what I wanted to share with Kenneth Tomlinson and his colleagues on the CPB board. In those days, there were still Republicans in America who did not march in ideological lockstep and who stood on principle against politicizing public television. The chairman of the public station in Dallas was an industrialist named Ralph Rogers, a Republican but no party hack, who saw the White House intimidation as an assault on freedom of the press and led a nationwide effort to stop it. The chairman at the time of the CPB was a former Republican congressman, Thomas Curtis, from here in St. Louis, from here in Missouri, who was also a principled man. He resigned, claiming White House interference. Within a few months, the crisis was over. CPB maintained its independence. PBS grew in strength, and Richard Nixon would face impeachment and resign for violating the public trust and not just public broadcasting. I once asked a friend of mine, a wise old man in Washington, what he learned from life. Could he reduce it to one sentence? And he said, yes, there ain't no justice in the world. Now get on with it. But here was cosmic justice, paradoxically. The very talk about justice, the very Public Affairs Center for Television that Nixon had tried to kill, IMPACT, put PBS on the map by rebroadcasting in prime time each day's Watergate hearings, drawing huge ratings night after night, and establishing PBS as an ally of democracy. We should still be doing that sort of thing. C-SPAN, bless its heart, shouldn't be the only channel, shouldn't be the only channel that lets us see how democracy works. That was 33 years ago, and I thought the current CPB board would like to hear and talk about the importance of standing up to political interference. I was wrong. They wouldn't meet with me. I tried three times and failed three times, and it was all downhill after that. I was naive, I guess. I simply never imagined that any CPB chairman, Democrat or Republican, would cross the line from resisting White House pressure to carrying it out for the White House. But that's what Kenneth Tomlinson has been doing. On Fox News, he denied he's carrying out a White House mandate or that he's ever had any conversation with any Bush administration official about PBS. But the New York Times reports that he enlisted Karl Rove to help kill a proposal that would have put on the CPB board people with experience in local radio and television. It was also reported that on the recommendation of administration officials, he hired a White House flack, I know the genre, named Mary Catherine Andrews as a senior staff member at CPB. While she was still reporting to Karl Rove at the White House, she set up CPB's new ombudsman office and had a hand in hiring the two people who will fill it, one of them who once worked for Tomlinson, the other a very respected journalist. But this is an anomaly. A political organization can't have an ombudsman. CPB is not a journalistic or news-gathering organization. PBS can have one. WGBH can have one. WNET can have one. But for a political organization to have two ombudsmen, a one ombudsman or a dozen? I would like to give Mr. Tomlinson the benefit of the doubt, but I can't. According to a book written about the Reader's Digest when he was its editor-in-chief, he surrounded himself with other right-wingers, a pattern he's now following for the staff at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I've already mentioned Ms. Andrews. Well, for acting president, he hired Ken Ferrer from the FCC. who was Michael Powell's enforcer when Powell was deciding how to go about allowing the big media companies to get even bigger. One of Ferrer's jobs was to engage in tactics designed to dismiss any serious objection to more media monopolies. And according to Eric Altman, Ferrer was even more contemptuous than Michael Powell of public participation in the process of determining media ownership. It was Ferrer who decided to issue a protective order designed to keep secret the market research on which the Republican majority on the commission based their vote to permit greater media consolidation. Now, let me say, it is not likely that with a guy like that as the chief operating officer of the CPB, you're going to find any public television producers saying, hey, let's do something on how big media is affecting democracy. Because what this leads to is preventive capitulation. As everyone knows, Mr. Tomlinson has put up a considerable sum of money, allegedly over $5 million, your money, for the new weekly broadcast featuring Paul Gigot and the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. Now, Gigot is a smart journalist, a sharp editor, and a fine fellow. I had him on Now several times, and I even proposed to PBS that he become a regular contributor on our show, The Conversation of Democracy, remember? All stripes. But I confess to some puzzlement that the Wall Street Journal, which in the past editorialized to cut PBS off the public tap, is now being subsidized by American taxpayers when its parent company, Dow Jones, had revenues in the first quarter of this year of $400 million. I thought public television was supposed to be an alternative to commercial media, not a funder of it. But in this weird deal, you get a glimpse of the kind of programming Mr. Tomlinson apparently seems to prefer. Alone of the big major newspapers, the Wall Street Journal has no op-ed page where different opinions can compete with its right-wing editorials. The journal's PBS broadcast is just as homogenous, right-wingers talking to each other. I think, Bob McChesney, you ought to demand equal time for Katrina Vandenhoevel and the editors of The Nation, or for Amy Goodman's Democracy. Now, there's an idea for you. You want public broadcasting to be balanced against all these elite establishment voices that get heard? Get Amy on public television. We didn't know this a year ago. We just learned it from the New York Times that last year Mr. Tomlinson had spent $10,000 to hire a contractor who would watch my show and report on political bias. That's right. He spent $10,000 of your money to hire a guy to watch Now to find out who my guests were and what my stories were. $10,000. Gee, Ken. For $2.50 a week, you could pick up a copy of TV Guide on the newsstand. A subscription is even cheaper, and I would have sent you a coupon that can save you up to 62%. Or, for that matter, Ken, all you had to do was watch the show. Or you could go online where the listings are posted. Hell, Ken, you could have called me collect, and I would have told you who we were having on the show. $10,000. That 10 grand would pay for the books in an elementary school classroom or an upgrade of its computer lab. But having sent that cash, what did he find? Only Mr. Tomlinson knows. He's apparently decided not to share the results with his staff or with the board or even to leak it to Robert Novak. I mean, when a right-winger won't leak to Robert Novak, you know he doesn't want it to go up the food chain of the right-wing echo chamber. The public paid for that study. But Ken Tomlinson acts as if he owns it. You can watch my bias. You can watch my mistakes. You can watch everything I do right there on the air. We have the funders listed. Everything is there. It's all listed. But he won't do it. In a May 10th op-ed piece in Reverend Moon's conservative Washington Times, Ken Tomlinson maintained he had not released the findings because public broadcasting is such a delicate institution. He did not want to, quote, damage public broadcasting's image with controversy. Where I come from in Texas, we shovel that kind of stuff every day. As we learned this week, that's not the only news Mr. Tomlinson tried to keep to himself. And as reported by Jeff Chester's Center for Digital Democracy, there were two public opinion surveys commissioned by CPB, but not released to the media, not even to PBS and NPR. According to a source who talked to Salam.com, the first results were too good, and Tomlinson didn't believe them. After the Iraq War, the board commissioned another round of polling, and they thought they'd get worse results, but they didn't. This is the man, by the way, who was running the Voice of America back in 1984 when a fanatic named Charlie Wick was politicizing the United States Information Agency, of which Voice of America was a part. It turned out there was a blacklist of people who had been removed from the list of prominent Americans sent abroad to lecture on behalf of America and the USIA. What's more, it was discovered that evidence as to how those people were chosen to be on the blacklist, more than 700 documents, had been shredded. Among those on the blacklist of journalists, writers, scholars, and politicians were dangerous left-wing subversives like Walter Cronkite, James Baldwin, Gary Hart, Ralph Nader, Ben Bradley, Coretta Scott King, and David Brinkley. The person who took the fall for the blacklist was another right-winger. He resigned. Shortly thereafter, so did Kenneth Tomlinson, who was one of six people in the agency with the authority to see the list of potential speakers and allowed to strike people's names. Let me be clear. I don't know, and there's no record of what position Kenneth Tomlinson took, whether he supported the blacklist or opposed it, or what he thinks of it now. I actually hoped Bill O'Reilly would have asked him about it. When he appeared on the O'Reilly Factor, he didn't. Instead, Tomlinson went on attacking me with O'Reilly egging him on and went on denying he was carrying out a partisan mandate. The only time you could be sure he was telling the truth was at the end of the broadcast when he said to O'Reilly, "We love your show." We? He's entitled to his opinion. He's entitled to his politics. He's entitled to contribute exclusively, as he does, to conservative candidates for public office. That's all fine. Our political system encourages it and tolerates it. But he is not entitled to stand in judgment on other people's bias. I wrote Kenneth Tomlinson. I asked him to sit down with me for an hour on PBS and talk about all this. I said, "You can choose the moderator, although I don't see that we need one, two civilized human beings sitting and talking about these important issues affecting the future of a medium we both profess to love." I said, "You can choose the guidelines. But there's one thing in particular," and I'm about to close. "There's one thing in particular I would like to ask him about." In that op-ed essay in the Washington Times, Ken Tomlinson talks of a phone call from an old friend complaining about Bill Moyers' bias. The friend explained that the foundation he heads made a six-figure contribution to his local public television station for digital conversion. But he declared, and I'm quoting Tomlinson, there would be no more contributions until something was done about the network's bias. Apparently, that's Kenneth Tomlinson's method of governance. Money talks and buys the influence it wants. But I'd like to ask him to listen to a different voice. This letter came to me last year, 5 pages of handwriting. It said, in essence, and I'm going to do some direct quoting, After the worst sneak attack in our history, there's not been a moment to reflect, a moment to let the horror resonate, to feel the pain and regroup as humans. No, since I lost my husband on 9/11, not only our family's world, but the whole world seems to have gotten even worse than that tragic day. On 9/11, my husband was not on duty. He was home with me, having coffee. Our own family story on that day is long and complicated. My daughter and grandson, living only 5 blocks from the tower, had to be evacuated with terror all around. My other daughter, near the Brooklyn Bridge, my son in high school. But my Charlie took off like a lightning bolt to be with his men from the Special Operations Command. "Bring my gear to the plaza," he told his aide immediately after the first plane struck the North Tower. In comparison to using semantical technicalities, passing the responsibility, or not having all the facts, he took action based on the responsibility he felt for his job and his men and for those towers he loved. If anything happens in the firehouse at any time, even if the captain isn't on duty and is on vacation, that captain is responsible for everything that goes on there 24/7. Why then, she asked, are the people in Washington responsible for nothing? Why do they pass the blame for what happened that day, for the failure of the system, for the torture at Abu Ghraib, for sending young soldiers into an immoral war, under-equipped, under-trained, and under-protected? Why is there no leadership? We need more programs like Now to wake us up, she said. Such programs must continue amidst the sea of false images and name-calling that divide America now. Such programs give us hope that search will continue to get this imperfect human condition onto a higher plane. So thank you. Without public broadcasting, all we would call news would be very carefully controlled propaganda. Let's take public broadcasting back. Take it back. Take it back from threats, from interference, from those who would tell us we can only think what they command us to think. We're big kids. We can handle controversy and diversity. Whether it's a political or religious points of view, or two loving lesbian moms and their kids visited by a cartoon rabbit. We're not too fragile or insecure to see America and the world entire for all their magnificent and sometimes violent confusion. There used to be a thing or commodity we put a store by, John Steinbeck wrote. It was called the people. Thank you.
You were just listening to Bill Moyers in defense of public broadcasting. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at the Conference on Media Reform in St. Louis. Bill Moyers was a renowned journalist, commentator, and staunch defender of public broadcasting. He was the winner of more than 30 Emmy Awards. He passed away in late June. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Amy Goodman, Claudia de la Cruz, Chris Hedges, Azad Issa, Vijay Prashad, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Bill Moyers in Defense of Public Broadcasting, and for Noam Chomsky's classic book, How the World Works, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Martin Folker. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Ella Fitzgerald and Duke Ellington. Take the A Train.
Sugar Hill, way up in Harlem. If you miss the A train, you'll find you've missed the quickest way to Harlem. Hurry, get on, now it's coming. Listen to those rails a thrumming. On board, get on the A train.
You are listening to News and Public Affairs, WRCT Pittsburgh, WRCT.org. Streaming.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Okay, I'm going to rewind. We talked about, 1993, coming out of Temple. My very first job was a leasing agent. I left there and did something totally different. And then one day, I was watching 9/11 on the television, and I got stuck. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I really wish that I could do something to help the people. What can I do? I need to be involved. And I'm not kidding. 6 months later, I got an opportunity to go into the Pentagon and be what they called a move manager. It was about being a change champion and convincing people that they had to move because the Pentagon was being renovated. And when I got into that building and I understood the job that I had, I understood the assignment, I fell completely in love with it. And then what made it so nice is that for me, it took where I started, back to that leasing agent.
Danini Conway, founder and president of Proven Management, LLC. Proven Management is a real estate and facility management firm specializing in project management, logistics, and space planning. They handle end-to-end solutions for both public and private sector high-profile and top-earning clients to ensure that their projects are executed with precision. They have project management, transition planning, interior design, and space planning experts on staff. These professionals include mathematicians who can calculate exact angles to get furnishing through doors, PhDs instead of mere movers to make key choices for the moving project decisions, and even engineers and other professionals to make color choices on interior design. While Conway can't reveal the names of her high-end clients, they do include government officials to Fortune 500 CEOs. I'm John L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Proven Management with founder and CEO Danita R. Conway, In Black America.
A male-dominated field to me felt very scary when I went into business in 2008. I didn't know how to navigate. As a female, I didn't understand money, truthfully. So I've already disclosed I've come from pretty much a single mother household as my father passed away when I was at a young age. So I wasn't taught and brought up about all the different investments and how to get people to want to believe in your ideas and fund your ideas. I didn't really even have a good credit score. So back in 2008, being in a male-dominated industry was just scary. What I did was I actually attached myself to a few males. And I watched them. I studied them. I treated entrepreneurship like it was a school.
Danita Conway's career in real estate and logistics began with her six-year tenure working on the Phoenix Project, the post-9/11 effort to rebuild the Pentagon. She also runs the Conway Foundation. After years of honing her skills and navigating challenges as an African-American woman in the real estate facility management industry, she took a leap of faith and founded Proven Management in 2008. Conway was committed to creating something that didn't just meet industry standards, but redefined them. It wasn't easy. She stayed committed to excellence and innovation. Surrounding herself with a talented, like-minded team was key, and together they've grown Proven Management into a recognized leader in the moving and logistic industry. Conway's innovative ideas and groundbreaking concept have set new industry benchmarks, becoming the gold standards others strive to emulate. Recently in Black America spoke with Danita Conway.
Washington, D.C. And first, let me go back and say thank you for having me. I feel so honored to be talking to you today.
It is definitely my pleasure.
I'm a native Washingtonian.
And brothers and sisters?
No, I'm an only child. I'm a product of Margaret and Ralph Conway. Both now are deceased, so it's just me.
Talk about your experience at Temple University Fox School of Business.
It was wonderful. So back in, I'm going to date myself, right? So a couple of decades ago, when I went to Temple, I didn't really understand what I was embarking on. The people that I met, so from Washington, D.C. all the way up to New York, just was powerful in my life. I love the professors. They're some of the ones that taught me to not be afraid of business. And I really do believe that it was my experience there working alongside good people and understanding the law of business, the marketing of business that actually made me want to go into business. As a matter of fact, I still keep in touch with plenty of my friends from Temple to today.
And any specialization that you majored in at Temple in the business school?
My major was dual, so I did international marketing and business law.
And also understand that you see specialized training at Harvard Business School, Goldman Sachs, and the U.S. Small Business Administration. Talk to us about those experiences.
You know what about those experiences, as well as much as I love Fox School of Business, I do believe that the best experience I've gotten was once I became a person actually in my industry. So I got the chance to go to Goldman Sachs in 2017. And while I was afraid to do it, and I say afraid to do it, it was just, who am I going to go up against? What am I going to learn? Have I been in the industry or been a professional long enough to actually know what I'm going to absorb? And that program, which lasted 6 months, is still a program that gives. So it opened up your mind. It transitioned you through finance to operations to customer service to human resources. There wasn't anything that they didn't touch. I love the program. And I also love the fact that Goldman Sachs actually still stays in touch with alumni and still wants to hear our voice. So that 10K small business, that voice is still very active. Attending classes at Harvard was nice. You know, it's all about learning more and being able to advance myself. So I often look for programs to be able to help me excel. Some people will think, well, you have achieved, so what can you learn? And I tell you, I learn every day. I look for a program to attend to excel myself in some area or just reinforce every day.
What was it about Realtor that sparked your interest?
Good question. I like the business of dealing with people. And it's really a convoluted answer for me. So because I've been doing it for so long now, I just love the architecture of real estate. I love the transactions of real estate. There's no more land going to be built. So actually being able to procure it, I wanted to be a realtor just to watch the reactions of when people get their home or find their space. But the part that really makes me happy is when I'm able to infuse my design skills and help them not only acquire the space, but transform the space to something that feels really special and personal to them.
So what led you to start your own company?
Chance. I got an opportunity back in 2007. And it's an opportunity that's almost emotional to me because not everybody is able to recognize an opportunity, if that makes sense. And if you would have asked me back in 1993, I'm coming straight out of Fox School of Business, if I wanted to be an entrepreneur, absolutely not. No, 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 I don't want to do it. I just want to do, you know, this. But when I start to...
You're listening to An Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM over the airwaves in the city of Pittsburgh, and streaming online to the world up on WRCT.org. WRCT is supported by Attic Records, located in Millvale. Attic Records is open 7